Hello, my name is Chris Pratt, and welcome to The Games Press, a podcast series in which I interview interesting people from around the games media about their work. In this episode, I'm going to be talking to IGN's Rebecca Valentine, who at the time of recording had just returned from this year's Summer Games Fest, which is being positioned as, I don't know, a sort of potential successor to the gaming industry's most bombastic trade show, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, better known as simply E3. Now, if you've been listening to the Games Press for a while, you might remember that we've had Tina Amini on before now, who up until more recently was the editor-in-chief over at IGN. And in that episode, we talked about her mission to transform the publication into a destination site for long-form investigative reporting. Rebecca Valentine, as you'll hear, was a key hire in making that vision a reality. So how's that been going? And what was Summer Games Fest like on the ground? We'll be talking about both of those things and plenty more, including, honestly, something of a therapy session on my own anxieties surrounding the job. So buckle in. But before we start, I'd also like to thank Loading Bar for continuing to support this very podcast and all of our other work at People Make Games. They've been with us since day dot, as PMG's Annie Sayers likes to say, and we're extremely grateful to them for that backing. If you don't know them already, then frankly, you've not been listening to our other podcast episodes, and that's rude, but in short, they run a set of free gaming bars across the south of England with venues in Hackney, Brighton, and Peckham. They're really lovely places to hang out and play some games with your pals, so pop your head in if you're ever in the area. It's a nice time. You can take that from us. And with that, it's about time we talk to Rebecca Valentine. It's a good name. It's a good name to say on a podcast. Better than Chris Pratt. Hello, Rebecca. Thank you for being on the podcast.
I cannot even express to you how much of an honor it is. I am a massive fan of your work. I was delighted
Likewise.
To be invited.
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm recording this. I have a day off, mm-hmm. which is wonderful in the wake of summer game chaos. Yeah. I left Tears of the Kingdom at home for like over a week while I was in LA doing all that, and so I just picked it up again like last night, and it mm-hmm. felt so good. And so I'm buzzing.
Oh, nice. Well, that's good. I feel like I want to be open about where my headspace is at right now, because this might be something that you can empathize with and might be interested to talk about. Like, we just published like a really big story that took months to complete. I feel really weird. I feel like really burnt out, and like it's kind of hard to get back into. Yeah. Work and not thinking about that story all the time, and as someone who also, you know, some of your stories you spent months working on with, like, you know, I know the Bungie piece, I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later on. How do you feel when like big pieces end up being published? How do you cope with it?
It's honestly an emotional roller coaster. It cycles between like anxiety and relief and mm-hmm. sort of a little bit of pride, mm-hmm. but then also there's so much. So like, I can have done 100 interviews and I can have fact checked everything down to the most minute detail. I can have run a piece through, you know, 10 different editors. I can have run it through multiple legal, like I can have run it through every possible gamut, and I can be sure from every possible angle that the thing I'm publishing is correct. And I still have this massive wave of dread the night before publishing something mm-hmm. that I got something wrong.
Yep.
Like just massive. And so the first couple of days after publishing something are this weird wave of relief when mm-hmm. nobody bangs on your door and says, this is wrong, actually. I know for a fact this is wrong. And I know that's ridiculous. Like, it doesn't come from a place of not doing the work. It doesn't come from a place of it doesn't come from a place of genuine uncertainty, if that makes sense. It's this weird just like fear that I am like failing somehow in a way that I cannot possibly have seen, which is not true, because I am like, we put the structures around us and we do the work to make sure that we are standing on as strong footing as possible. So like the first several days are this relief, but then like the thing you're describing, you start getting away from it and it becomes this sort of, oh, now I have to find something else. Like now, like it starts up again.
Sure.
And you know, you have this thing looming before you, and maybe you have a story like that, you know, you want to work on next, or maybe you don't. Like it's not that there's a shortage of stories in the industry, but sometimes I've got a running list going, and I'll look back at this list of things I want to work on, and I'm like, oh, some of these aren't timely anymore.
Some of the ones on my list are just bad, but I just keep them on there just to make the list look a little bigger and make me feel better.
Absolutely. I have a couple pitches on mine that I'm like, yeah, I shouldn't. long. But yeah. And it feels daunting and it feels really, really big. But then like it's coupled with sort of the anxiety of being in this like very capitalistic world where if we are not producing something, we are failing somehow. It's like kind of this, I mean, I guess for me, it comes from being a freelancer for a while. I mean, you all like have a very different situation where you are, I don't know what the right word is, basically like self-made, self-employed in that regard, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. The crowdfunding is like almost all of what funds People Make Games, like vast majority of it is crowdfunding, like a little tiny bit from YouTube advertising, but we wouldn't even be able to pay one person's salary off that. So, which is great. It means like you get the freedom in some respects that comes with that. But also the crowdfunding, like every month dips a little bit when you're not active, as people, you know, move away and, or you're not bringing in like new eyeballs on the latest thing that you've just done. And that can sometimes add to that same feeling you're talking about. It can make these moments feel a little strange. I'm actually in a slightly, a spot, I guess, this is turning into a therapy session. I'm sorry. It's just, there aren't that many people that can relate to this exact feeling. But it's not so much that I don't know what to work on, that I wouldn't be able to find the next story to work on. It's just, I'm trying to figure out what kind of vibe that I want to surround myself in for the next few months. It's been like back to back some really like involved, like really serious high stakes stories, and I'm just a little broken at the end of it. So I think part of it right now is like, hang on, how do I go back to like doing smaller, more like lighthearted or more generally positive like work? Because I think my brain needs that right now.
Yes.
I think I've heard you talk about this before, but when you put out a big piece looking at studio culture or something, you often get other people reaching out being like, oh, here's like something similar you should be looking into. And right now my brain is just like, I can't do one of those right now.
Yeah. It's a thing that like we don't really talk about a lot in this line of work, which I understand why, because kind of the rule of like talking about trauma is that you comfort in and you dump out. Like if you're closer to the trauma, you get to dump out to people who are further away from it and like complain about that to those people. But then anyone who's closer to it than you comfort them. You don't dump your trauma on them.
Sure.
Basically like that. There's like a whole diagram someone made. I don't know. It's really smart. But like as journalists, you know, we're, you know, especially for those more serious stories, like the Bungie Report is a really good example. I've done some others that are like that too, where you're sitting there for like sometimes hours listening to people recount some of their worst experiences, depending on what it is. And the truth that I think a lot of people don't realize is a lot of that doesn't even end up in the reports. Mm-hmm. And it's not because we don't want to talk about it, but it's because, you know, it would identify our sources because they're very specific experiences, or maybe it's somebody who just really isn't ready for that information to be public even without their name on it. And so, but they still want to talk about it, so they end up telling you about it, and you end up having to absorb all this, and you can't complain to them, obviously. Of course not, no. Like that would be ridiculous, but you also can't complain about it publicly. I guess it's get in therapy if you're a journalist. But yeah, you know, you're exactly right. And you're right. You worked on these two like very serious pieces back to back. And I think it's both important to remember that game development and making games is not, it's not like this just massively depressing, somber thing. It's not meant to be. It's meant to be a joyful artistic process. And there's plenty of stories of that happening, but it's also like, I don't know, it's sort of harder to wrap your head around those stories sometimes because you want to find like some sort of interesting nugget to tell people, as opposed to, hey, game development is going great and everything is fine. Like that's not a headline, but there are headlines. I don't mean to say there's not joyful stories. There's plenty of them. It's just, it's not, people are not in my DMs saying, hey, I have a really fun story for
that's
you.
That's so true. Generally. That's so true. This is, this was a question I meant to ask you later on, but it makes so much sense to move it here, which is, I've heard you talk recently about kind of the future of long form reporting across the games industry and how you hoped it would bring in a wider breadth of topics. It was on a podcast that you were on last year. You talked about how...
I'm delighted that you listen to these things and remember them. It's like really flattering.
You talked about how like the... not all investigative work in this space needs to be about trauma, which I thought was an interesting observation, partly because, like I said, it feels like a lot of the work that I've been doing recently has been to do with, you know, crunch or discrimination or workplace abuse, and all those things are super important topics, need the spotlight, of course, nobody's saying that they don't, but that there should be a greater balance of that kind of work across other areas. And like you say, it's hard to sometimes get to those places. Folks don't usually reach out with, here's a really good thing that's happening that you should definitely spend the next 2 months reporting on.
Yeah.
It happens sometimes, not as much
but they
as
do
like.
But it's PR who does it, and it's sure. usually like very sanitized and scripted. Yep. Is the thing.
And also that thing that I touched on before, which is once you have done some work that looks at something controversial, you tend to build a reputation for that. You tend to yep. be seen as like in an industry that doesn't always know how to deal with those moments. Like the media is a tool for some people to mm-hmm. to get those stories out there, and you become kind of synonymous with that. But yeah, I thought it was a really interesting observation, not one I'd heard a lot of people talk about within the space. Like the games media has done a lot of growing up recently, and it's meant that we can tackle these kind of subjects more, but then maybe like we can go broader than that, I suppose. Yeah, I don't know if you have any more thoughts about that since the podcast that
yeah.
I'm referring to.
Yeah, and I think it's right there in the name of your work, right? People make games, like human beings, people make them. And stories about human beings are interesting. People are interesting. And I found a lot of inspiration in the last year or two. And I actually don't remember if I was talking about this on that podcast or not. I have no idea what the timeline of my life is anymore. But I have been reading a lot of books about journalism in the last couple of years, and just journalism in general. Like, and I think it's very easy to sort of get stuck in our own heads and call what we do games journalism and call it this very specific thing, but it is just functionally, fundamentally journalism. And journalism is about all kinds of things. And I've been reading a lot more long form reporting, a lot more new journalism. Basically these really cool embedded stories where people are just sort of going into communities or spending a lot of time with people and telling these untold stories about just humanity, like living, like people, jobs that you don't normally think about or communities you don't normally think about. And yeah, I've been thinking a lot about how we apply that to games specifically. And I think one of the reasons why we don't already is because games is so incredibly secretive and locked down. And I guess comparatively easy for me to sort of walk into a random, like, I don't know, blue collar job in America and say, hey, I really want to learn everything there is to know about this job and how you do this job. And like, I just want to write about it. I want to learn about it. And I, depending on the job, obviously people might be a little more secretive, but generally that sort of curiosity is rewarded. But in games, because everybody is so locked down and afraid that you're going to spill their secrets, which, you know, is what journalism is, they won't give you the time of day, which is why I think there's so much misinformation and misunderstanding of how game development works. And one of the things that contributes to sort of fan culture being what it is. So I don't know how we break those walls down necessarily, but I've been trying to find ways to practice asking different kinds of questions and making my intentions like really clear from the outset when I'm talking to developers about their craft and about what they do and about their experiences. And I'm hoping that like over time we can sort of wear down those walls a little bit. You know, we don't necessarily need to be leaking a game to be able to tell interesting stories about game development.
I agree. I should say, actually, I think you recommended a book that I really, really liked called The New Journalism.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking about. Yeah,
by Robert Boynton. And it's, yeah, kind of an evolution of the original new journalism, which could sometimes feel quite extractive of people going into communities and telling their stories in interesting but not always empathetic ways, I guess. And new journalism is kind of a more modern version of that, I suppose, in which that is prioritized. And yeah, I really, really loved it. So given that this is a podcast that I imagine some people who like journalism are listening to, good recommendation. I wanted to move back to where I thought this interview was going to start, which was we had Tina Romini on the Games Press a while back, the former editor-in-chief at IGN.
Best.
Back when she was. She now works at Xbox these days. And when we spoke to her, she was talking about her push in that position to make IGN a publication better known for long-form reporting. And you being hired was you know, a part of that. You were brought on to make that a reality. So what's that been like? And also with Tina having now left, how's that continuing? Like what are people thinking within IGN about long form reporting.
Yeah, when I first got hired, and this was exactly the pitch that Tina gave me. You know, I think I applied for like a news writer or a staff writer role that was just like I assumed was just going to be sort of aggregation. Mm-hmm. I'd been doing reporting at gamesindustry.biz, and I really, really loved reporting, and I was hoping I'd be able to get to do a little bit at IGN, but I was kind of assuming that it would mostly just be aggregation. And so when I showed up to the interview and started talking about reporting and everybody lit up, I was very flabbergasted. And I truly thought when I started that, oh, yeah, they'll let me do reporting for a couple months, but they're going to throw me back on news aggregation. Like, there's no way. And I am now two and a half years in, I think, and I'm still doing reporting. I'm kind of blown away by it. I mean, I freely admit I had like sort of an idea in my head of what IGN was, mm-hmm. And IGN based on IGN's history, and I mean, it was grounded in things in a way that IGN had actually been. But I think, especially if you're somebody who's listening to this and hasn't read IGN in several years, I would really encourage you to like dip back in and look at some of the stuff we've been doing the last couple of years, because Tina really did like set up a legacy of good journalism and good reporting. And even just in the day-to-day news aggregation, like the standards and the effort that is put into every single story is it's so good right now. Like I'm really, really proud to be a part of that news team. In some ways, like I'm still afflicted by just sort of the winds of this industry and kind of the way that it works. Like by and large, I am left alone most days to just sort of pursue, you know, I have a list of stories that I'm working on. I have short-term, medium-term, and long-term stuff. I actually, this year, I'm super stoked about this because I've been talking about career advancement and I'm like, okay, what does it look like to be a reporter? I don't want to be an editor. I don't want to be a boss. I want to report. I want to become, I pitch them. Okay, so I got promoted to senior reporter this year. I pitched them on a track that I just got promoted, so this wouldn't be for many, many years, but a track that, you know, I stay at IGN for like 10 years or whatever. Get this. I want to be reporter at large. I want that title so bad. It's like an old journalism title, but it also sounds like I'm doing crimes, which is great.
It does. Absolutely does.
So good. But yeah, like that's what I pitched them on, and they're like, cool, yeah, let's like figure out how to do that. And part of that has been mentoring. I just hit my coffee. Mentoring upcoming reporters. So we've got a freelance group that does like day-to-day news aggregation for us, but I've also been sort of reaching out to some up and coming folks who are, you know, they have writing skills. They've maybe done like a little bit of community reporting, but don't have, it's hard to do that freelance. It really is, especially if you're just starting out. So I'm trying to work with a couple people to like work with them on community stories, because it's a really great place to start and do some like short-term projects. And that's been going really well so far too. So like, I don't know. I'm kind of flabbergasted at how well it's worked. And we have this really incredible team of people. Like Alex Stedman got brought over from Reviews, and she's doing day-to-day news editing, but she's also an amazing entertainment reporter in her own right. She came from Variety. She understands that field like way better than I ever could, and I'm learning a lot from her. We got Taylor Lyles working on the tech beat. We just hired Wesley Yinpool from Eurogamer.
Say,
yeah.
Speaking of mentorship, like Wes is my mentor in this space. Like I've told this story before, but I joined Eurogamer on the video team. He was sat like next to me in the office doing reporting, and I just remember thinking, your job is cooler than mine, so I'm going to try and start doing some of that in my job and see what happens. But was it a conversation like after Tina left that like, is it just set into the DNA a bit now of where IGN is? Like, it's not just one person's vision. It's like
I think it has to be. And we've had some other turnover as well. Like we had Joe Screbbles at the top of the news department,
and then he left.
And then Matt Kim was on the news team and he went over to features. But then we got Kat Bailey as well. Mm-hmm. And Kat Bailey ran US Gamer. And Kat Bailey, that woman champions reporting. Like she cares about it so deeply. And so I think if someone knocked on our door tomorrow and said, hey, actually, we want you to do less reporting, the entire news team would just start screaming at this point, because we're all like all five of us are so incredibly invested in it. But we also don't feel that way because John Davidson, our publisher, he also comes from journalism, and he's been really good at advocating as well for the importance of reporting, because it's hard in like a big organization like IGN. Like, you know, I mean, I think it's hard for you know, companies that don't necessarily like Ziff Davis, I don't think considers itself a journalism company. Mm-hmm. Like they have a whole bunch of different companies that they own that, you know, IGN does dozens of different things. Reporting is a relatively new thing. And so you need someone like John to basically step up and say, hi, like here is why this is important. Here is what we get out of this. Here's why we should champion it. And he's been great, I think, at explaining that to them and then getting the support that we need to build this team. So I think I hadn't thought about it this way before, but I think your characterization of it is accurate, that it used to be Tina kind of standing somewhere going, hey, we need journalism. Mm-hmm. And now we have like 6 or 7 people who have all been brought on by her and kind of left this legacy all going, yeah, journalism, that's what we're doing. I think that's a really good way to put it.
So speaking of big, ambitious reporting at IGN, I think one of the stories that you're maybe most well known for in that space now is your reporting on Bungie and the work culture there, like particularly throughout the development of Destiny 1 and 2. For those that haven't read it, do you want to just give like a brief overview of some of what you found there? I know it's a big piece, but just the top level stuff.
Yeah, so it is quite a big piece, but basically it is sort of the story of Bungie's history of having a not great work culture that has improved over the mm-hmm. years, but because it was sort of rooted in, you know, a bunch of kind of toxic masculinity mm-hmm. sort of stuff, like it has been very difficult to sort of turn that ship around, especially as the company has grown over the years to like what it was like 800 people, if I remember that. Yeah, I don't know what it is now. There's kind of a specific zoom in on the narrative department during Destiny 2's development, where there was just a lot of like a lot of not listening to women, a lot of crunch, like tons and tons of crunch. The big takeaway from that report is that work culture was toxic for many, 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 many years. It was not toxic for everyone. There were plenty of people who benefited from it. There were plenty of people who had a great time. They were largely white and male. And then in recent years, there have been kind of gentle nudges in a better direction. And most of those were driven by underrepresented folks within the company. So, you know, that's always the case. And I think that's what was so eye-opening to me about the Bungie report is that, yes, I know I'm a woman in this industry too. Like, people internally are always advocating for better, but sort of hearing, like speaking to people who had worked there, who had been like, yeah, things have been bad here. They are better now. That does not absolve the people who have done wrong and who have not been held accountable. But also we want to make sure that it is recognized that like, it's the whole idea whenever it's something, I'm sorry, I'm just jumping around all over the place.
No, please do.
When all that Activision Blizzard stuff came out, there was this big outcry on social media and everyone was like, burn it to the ground, the whole company's bad, which is not true. I'm going to keep just saying the name of you guys. People make games. Human beings make them. The vast majority of people who work in studios are just people with jobs who want to make art. And like the vast majority of people at Bungie over the years are not toxic. Can I swear on this podcast?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
They're not toxic shitheads. But a lot of people in power behaved really badly and made it very difficult for everyone else to exist. And so over time, because the industry has changed and because we've been able to get more diverse people in, those efforts have gained more ground. And so Bungie has been improving over the years because people are clawing for that betterness. And it's this sort of very difficult balance of, hey, a lot of people that behaved really badly at these companies, a lot of individuals were never held accountable. And they're just sort of running around and maybe they can say, oh, well, I've learned better. You know, I know better now. But what about the people they hurt? Like, we never did anything about that. And it's just sort of, okay, well, we've moved on and never addressed it. And how do you reconcile the need for accountability and justice with making sure that people have the space they need to learn and grow? And I don't have an answer for that. I truly don't. I've talked to a lot of people over the last year who are trying to find one because we desperately need one. But yeah, like that was my big takeaway from the Bungie report. Mm-hmm.
I think that's perfect.
It really transformed how I think about that kind of stuff in this space and how I go into reporting these things.
And so how does, I know that's a story that you worked on for several months and
oh, yeah.
yeah, like, I've heard you talk before as well about all the revisions with different editors being involved, and the, you know, you need to run that through your legal team at IGN, and it's a long process. There's almost 30 interviews that went into it. Very complicated piece. But where does it first start? When did you become aware that this was a story you might be interested in, or even that you might be able to get access to it in some form?
It was a weird confluence of two completely unrelated events. I was very casually having a conversation with somebody who mentioned they knew somebody at Bungie who had a story. And I kind of, you know, filed that away in my brain and was like, okay, well, that might be something to pursue next. And then 2 days later, completely unrelated, like I did as much checking as possible to make sure that these were not like the same incident. I got an anonymous tip to my inbox that was like, hey, you need to be looking into Bungie. And it like gave me some names to reach out to. Right. And like, I was just like, wow, like this is weirdly serendipitous.
The universe is sort of telling you.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a happy story, but yeah, like that. So those two things at once, and I had some time. And so I just sort of poked at it a little bit, and it became quickly apparent after like two conversations. I was like, okay, well, I got to work on this.
So in the story, most of the people you spoke to remain anonymous for very understandable reasons. A few share their names, but that speaks to something that is going to be running through this whole story, which is that people are going to be extremely nervous about talking about it.
Oh yeah,
particularly if they still work there, but even if they don't anymore, the fear of retribution, all the obvious reasons why it's nerve-wracking to talk about these kinds of things. So how do you manage to interview 26 people who about something they're going to very rightly be nervous to talk about with a journalist?
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, I did start with a couple of leads. And so whenever I'm just trying to figure out if there's a story somewhere at all, I start by talking to, you know, the leads that I have, and I'll ask them if they can recommend anybody else to talk to. And so you get, you know, assuming there is actually a story there, which there was in this case, you get kind of a little handful of people who can sort of corroborate each other's stories and tell you what's going on. But that's not enough, right? Because like, look, in the Bungie case, there's certainly like everything was very locked down, but like you can get, look, I've had people reach out to me for other stories where I talked to a couple people and they all corroborated something and it sounded horrible. But then when I started asking around other people, it was like, oh, this is like kind of a group of people at the studio who have historically been like kind of crappy to everybody else, and they're sort of trying to use your journalism to cause problems. And it's really hard because then you become an arbiter of someone else's conflict, and that's not what I'm here for. So it's really important to reach out to people who are unrelated to these folks and like make sure that it's solid. And so I actually find LinkedIn to be an incredible tool for this. I freaking love LinkedIn. I believe you've also been in the conversation where we learned about LinkedIn for journalists.
Yes, tell people, because I only found this out very recently and have been paying for premium before then for like,
yeah, if you a are while. A journalist and don't have LinkedIn for journalists, get on that, people. I think you probably just Google it and find it, but basically you sign up for LinkedIn for journalists, and then they do seminars every like 2 to 3 months or so. It's an hour-long webinar. I'm so sorry if you are a representative of LinkedIn.com listening to this. You can totally just mute it and not listen to it.
Last time I went with mine, they didn't even do the webinar. They like,
oh yeah, they didn't do mine either.
And they were like, hey, just, you know what, here you go. We couldn't find time to do that.
Yeah, I did listen to it the first year, like in good faith, because I was curious if it would teach me anything, but it was basically just an hour-long advertisement for LinkedIn, so.
Yeah, right, of course, yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, sure. But yeah, so it's an hour-long webinar, and then you get LinkedIn Premium for a year, and all you have to do to so you actually have to be a journalist. You can't just be a random person. You have to have credentials. Freelancers, you can, usually, if you have bylines that you can share. I think you have to share a couple bylines.
Yeah, and we were able to do it. We work on YouTube, which I was a little nervous about because often people want, you know, a name of a recognizable publication with bylines. But they apparently they looked at a YouTube channel and were like, yeah, fine, go on, here you go.
Good for them. Yeah. But yeah, so you do have to be a journalist with like some sort of byline credentials. You sign up for it. You get free LinkedIn Premium for a year. All you have to do to re-up it every year is attend the webinar again or sign up for it and then have them cancel it. And LinkedIn Premium, if you were unaware, is incredible because it basically gives you, what does it give you now? Like 40, 50 free in-mails a month. It's a certain amount. It's a lot. And they roll over as well, I think, to a certain degree. I found myself with like 60 free in-mails before. It's ridiculous. But LinkedIn is a really great tool for being able to reach out to people, at least in the games industry, and as sources, because you can send these free messages to people. Most people use LinkedIn sporadically in the games industry, sporadically enough that they will check it. Like, they're not on it constantly the way we're all on Twitter, but they'll check it like once a week, or they'll get a notification that they have a message and they'll check it out. And you can reach out to them. And I leave them with my email, and I leave them with my Signal number for secure communication. But I basically just send them an intro like, hey, I'm this person. I work here. I'm working on a story about this. I was hoping you'd be able to tell me a little bit about your experience with that. And then the thing that this goes back to your original question about how I get people to talk when they're really nervous about it. I try to offer people like, hey, we can speak anonymously. If you just want to know more about how that works, before you commit to anything, I am super happy to just talk you through it.
That is such a good thing that I don't know that I always realized like earlier in my career that like that language, because it's so common within our world, that actually if this is the first time you've ever been interviewed, it really helps to actually know mm-hmm. what on the record and off the record means, because actually you find out that people think off the record can mean a variety of different things. Mm-hmm. They're usually more short on the record. But yeah, that is now like a definitive way that I start almost every mm-hmm. interview, which is like, let's just talk about this to make sure you know what it means. Because turns out not everyone does.
Yeah. I offer that to people. I offer to hop on a call with them. I'll explain it over email. I'll do whatever. And I'll also explain like how I keep them anonymous as well, which is like sort of it. Everything is very dependent on the story, of course, because like, you know, if I'm talking to the CEO of a company, most likely I'm not making that person anonymous because they're speaking in like a very professional corporate capacity. And, you know, they don't get anonymity. PR doesn't get anonymity, but like some, you know, Joe game developer who is just trying to protect their job. Yeah, of course. And so, you know, here.
I can't believe you've just outed them by revealing their full name. Unbelievable, Rebecca.
Yeah. Like, and there's different things we can do. And some of that is just basic, is explaining to them, again, like people don't know, but I explain to them, hey, I'm not going to use your name. I'm not going to use your job title. Sometimes you need to identify based on like department or gender, like, because, you know, for stories about sexism, it's important to know if a source was a woman. So there's like some things, but it very much depends on the story, but just talking people through like how that could look. Because I found that a lot of people sort of assume I get a lot of responses that are like, hey, I feel like I should talk about this, but I'm really worried that my story is so specific, it's going to out me. Like, if you mention my department or my job title, people will know it was me. And I'm like, well, there's no need to mention that. Like, I have no purpose for doing that in this situation. So just walking them through and being willing to explain that to them. And honestly, I've had a couple times where I've walked people through that and they've been like, hey, I still don't think it's for me. And I don't consider that time wasted, because they still appreciated learning about it. And, you know, maybe they'll feel more comfortable approaching it in the future for a different story, or maybe they'll tell other people, hey, like I didn't feel comfortable, but maybe you should talk to her.
Just to finish up on that that Bungie story. So that, yeah, you've managed to build this network of sources. You've spoken to so many people. At what point do you think to yourself, okay, I've now got enough to write this story? How do you know when you're done reporting?
I guess to sort of finish out the thought from before. So like I start with sort of the close people that, you know, tipped me off or that I know can talk about it. And then I move to sort of cold reaching out to people, usually on LinkedIn. Sometimes I'll use other things too. Twitter has been less helpful lately. Yeah. you know, there's various other means to sort of reach people. And then but you kind of move up the chain, right? Like you sort of reach out to people like, okay, this person worked in the department that I'm writing about, or, oh, this person worked there during those years, so they'd probably know. And then usually, again, very dependent on the story, but usually the final thing is like reaching out to people who are current employees of a place, like cold. And that's always risky, because those folks are the most likely to sort of out you and go to HR and be like, hey, a reporter is talking to me, and then HR tries to shut the whole thing down and it becomes a whole mess, or PR or whoever. So usually it kind of follows those steps. And by the time I reach that point, I have a very clear picture of what happened. But generally I know that I'm done when I've run out of big questions. I might still have some small questions that I can get details on from the people I've already spoken to, but it very much feels like filling in a puzzle and you're putting in puzzle pieces. And then when all the big holes are filled, you're like, okay, we got it. Like, I don't need to talk to anybody else. You know, sometimes there's smaller questions like, okay, this article has conversations about sexism. Did I talk to enough women? Did I talk to like one woman and a bunch of men, which is going to give you a very different picture. This is an article about a very specific time in this game's development. Did I talk to, are the people that I spoke to people who worked there during that specific time, or, did I get a little far afield? So, kind of things like that. But yeah, I guess generally just when I'm out of big questions, when I can write a draft beginning, middle, and end and be like, okay, yeah, this thoroughly explains it. There's nothing missing.
We talked right at the beginning of this interview about anxiety to do with reporting. I don't know if I really believe this, but this is the way that I make myself feel better, is that I think being a really anxious person can help reporting sometimes. Yeah. because it means that I find that I end up reporting more than I need to, or feel that I go further than I would otherwise, because I really don't want to mess this up. I don't want to let down all the people that have put trust into me. And
yes,
I tend to, like, on some of the bigger pieces we've done recently, I can really feel that I've maybe gone like 4 or 5 interviews more than I needed to in some cases. And I'm pretty happy with that. I think that's not a bad safety net to sometimes have in mind. Part of me feels like, I wish I was less anxious in this job. Uh-huh. And then there's a quiet voice that's like, but what if you were really confident? That might be a problem too. What if you were overconfident?
Yeah.
So that's how I make myself feel better about being an absolute wreck of a human being.
No, I very much identify with that. I have been trying to combat my worst tendencies on that front lately, because I do absolutely overreport things. And I'm better at it now. I still do it, but I'm better at it now. I'm not going to tell you how long the Budgie report was in its first draft form.
Right.
too long. Absolutely unreadable. Way too much random detail and explanation, unnecessary. I have another report that I'm working on now that is still too long, but it is far more concise than anything else I've ever written. And I actually really admire people who can sort, because, like, look, I have a really good, Kat Bailey is a fantastic editor, because she is specifically the opposite of me. She is concise, and she's a very good sense. I don't know if it's because she's been doing this for so long or what. She has a great source sense for when she has exactly the right amount of sources she needs. And she's just able to call it and say, okay, that's great, we can go on that. And I'm panicking. I'm like, oh my God, no, we need like 10 more sources. No, why? What does that do for you? Like, are you not confident in the ones we have? And sometimes I'm not. And sometimes I'm able to sort of explain why. And then she's like, okay, you're right, we need more, like, go do that. But sometimes the answer is, I am confident, I'm just nervous. And when that's the answer, then it's like, go write the draft, you're fine. And so I've really, really benefited from working with her and being able to sort of force myself to answer that question for myself. Am I actually not confident, or am I just anxious? I think that's the right phrase. I don't know.
I know what you mean. I definitely know what you mean. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so a bit of a change in pace now. E3 didn't happen this year.
The artist formerly known as E3.
You actually broke the news that this year's expo, like, wouldn't be happening back in March.
Sure did.
How did that come about? How did you end up breaking that story? And also, I'm going to put you on the spot again. Could you, like, quickly, like, summarize what was going on there? Like, why didn't E3 happen this year?
Oh, I will try to summarize this. This is a fun, winding story. So I actually have been working, I worked on that story for a year, technically, because I'm going to vent a little bit. I'm going to dip. So in 2022, we also did not have E3. And I was working on a story then that E3, the physical event had been canceled. I didn't know yet that the digital event, they were still kind of wishy-washy about that, but I had that story. It was done. I reached out to the ESA for comment, and I gave them till the end of the day. I was prepared to publish it. 2 hours later, GamesBeat came out with a story that E3 was going digital only. And they had a statement from the ESA, and the ESA emailed me like 5 minutes after their story went up with their statement. So what I very strongly suspect happened is I sent them that and they went to GamesBeat and gave them the news. I don't think GamesBeat actually scooped me reporting wise. So I'm a little salty about that. But I'd been working on that story at the time because that year there had been a lot of concern from developers, people at, you know, at GDC, at DICE, at other places about what was going on with that show, right? Because E3, I mean, there was a really great report several years ago by Brian Crescente about, you know, kind of some of the chaos that had been going on inside the ESA. You know, obviously it happened in 2019. It was fine. 2020, it got canceled due to the pandemic. And then in 2021, it kind of came out with a really mediocre digital version. And then 2022, there was just all this, is it going to come back? Is it not? We don't know. And there was like a serious lack of confidence. And E3 had already kind of been in a weird spot. Like Sony had pulled out several years ago. I think they were out in 2019, if I remember right. And we just kind of knew that it was on shaky foundations. There was a lot of reason to think that. And so I had been poking around and asking people like, hey, have you heard anything about this? Have you heard anything about this? And there was just like nobody. We were getting like fairly like, because it takes time. It takes time to set up booths. It takes time to like spend, like allocate money to this budget for E3. And all these developers were like, what's going on? We don't know. Usually we've heard by now. And so I was able to sort of poke around and ask some people who are normally close enough to hear that kind of stuff. And I figured out they weren't doing a physical edition and they, you know, gave my scoop away, which infuriated me and made me all the more powerful as a result. And so I let it go at that point. I was a little salty because the scoop that I had was that they had not yet decided to do a digital version. I believe the story that came out that they were going to do a digital version was an inaccurate interpretation of that quote. I'm still a little salty about that. I'm so sorry. Anyway, all that aside. Listen,
that can be a helpful feeling sometimes.
Don't give my stories away, ESA. Just don't do it. Anyway,
your contact information.
In late 2022, or my contact information, God. In late 2022, early 2023, I was starting to hear the same rumblings that I had heard the previous year. I was at the Game Awards, and I was kind of talking to people, and they were all like, yeah, like we haven't, they say they're coming back. We haven't heard anything yet. It's still a little early. Maybe it's fine. And just continually poking and poking and poking, and the noise around that kept getting louder. And, you know, we got into the new year, and I continued to ask around, and we got a couple reports out. Like I'm trying to remember exactly the order of events, but I believe we ran a story about how people were, or I think we ran a story that Nintendo had backed out. I think that was ours. Kat got that. And then someone else got a story that someone else had pulled out. I don't remember the exact order of events, but there were basically like several reporters who were all on this kind of at the same time. And then the day that it happened, a bunch of people knew that I was on the story because I had been asking so many different developers and publishers and people about it for a while. I got two texts simultaneously that morning that were just from completely different people that were just, hey, I heard E3 was canceled. You know anything about that? And I'm like, what? And so I'm frantically texting them back, like, where did you hear this? What's going on? And I'm calling my boss, like, hey, drop everything. I think I got a scoop. And I don't think I was like shaking because I knew it was going to get out. And so in 20 minutes, I wrote up this story because I was able to get, I reached back out to them and I was able to get confirmation. And then I called, like right as it, I was ready to go with it. I called my PR contact for the ESA and I was like, hey, I need an answer like now because I'm going with this. And they were just like, we can't comment, but we know why you're calling. And so, yeah, I just had it and I ran it. But yeah, that's like maybe a truncated version of everything that goes into it. But
sure. No, well, I'm glad to know that eventually there's some kind of redemption there.
It was catharsis.
Yeah. And yeah, so it obviously hasn't happened this year in any form. It's unclear what the show's future is, but obviously Summer Games Fest has emerged to try and take some of that space. And you were at that show. So obviously it was Summer Games Fest itself, which is like the Jeff Keighley led thing. And then alongside that, there's a bunch of game showcases like Xbox and Ubisoft and the PC gaming show, those kind of things that are like not officially tied to Summer Games Fest, but it's all around the same time, kind of mirroring some of what we used to expect from E3. So you were at Summer Games Fest. I wasn't. What was it like?
It felt, I think, I want to believe that in 10 years or so, I'll be, you and I will be sitting in a bar at, you know, whatever this thing becomes. It'll be this huge thing. And I'll be going, oh yeah, I remember the first SGF. Oh my gosh, that was kind of, it was like very small. That was kind of cool. Like I'll be reminiscing about the beginnings of the show in the same way that a lot of people used to reminisce about the old E3s. I think it's going to be very different though. And I'm not sure what its final form looks like. It feels decentralized. Like Keighley is kind of like sort of the center point that it's all hovering around, but actually I would say, yeah, he's like, you know, the sun and everybody's sort of orbiting.
I often think about him in such ways.
But actually I think it's more like twin suns at this point, because Xbox I think is a huge component. Like the events that are going on here in person are Playdays, which is a 2-day media event that Keighley puts on that's attached to SGF. There's some games in there that are in Summer Games Fest. There's a lot of games that are not. I was there last year. It was kind of just one small event space. This year it had expanded into kind of like a lot. It's still the same event space, but then there's like some spaces next door that it expanded into. There were like banners up on the walls. It felt very micro E3 in that regard, but also it was all media, no business, no public, just media and PR people. But then Xbox was doing stuff down the road, and they had like a mixer, they had a panel that they gave, they had a fan fest, which was open to the public, and they did have, I think they had a game. I did not go to the fan fest. I was doing interviews. They had like interview opportunities. Like it was much more E3 in that regard, because they brought the executives out to kind of do some stuff. Ubisoft, I believe, did a live show also kind of in the same area. And then there was kind of that very E3 feeling of, oh, we don't have a game on the show floor, but do you want to get a drink at the bar in the hotel next door? Or let's all go to the JW Marriott afterwards. And then you run into like Hideo Kojima there. I did not run into Hideo Kojima, but you know, that's like the kind of thing that happens at these things.
What was the access like more generally? Because I saw that you and a few other people were able to get one-on-one interviews with Matt Booty from the head of Xbox Game Studios. And you mentioned that they kind of put some exec stuff forwards, like the panel and the Giant Bomb interview as well. But like more generally, was like how much access was there? Because it felt like from across the other side of the world that there were fewer like big stories coming out of it that hadn't come from the presentations themselves. You know,
it was like mostly Xbox in terms of access. Like I think they have very strong reasons lately to bring out their executives and bring them forward and try to foster those relationships with the media. And last year they did the same thing. Like they were very, like they do this mixer event where it's off the record, but it's just like drinks and hors d'oeuvres, but they bring out Phil Spencer and Chris Charla. Chris Charla and I had like a 45 minute conversation about the fact that he's a crow guy. Like he feeds crows and then they follow him around and attack his enemies for him. Like, you know,
I know a crow guy. I know a crow guy. Yeah.
Chris Charla's
Dan
very
Pearson,
cool.
Crow guy.
But yeah, it's that kind of thing. And I think that's very good for them. So it was very localized specifically to Xbox. Like I was offered a couple other interviews. I'm not going to out who they were with, but I'm not running them because they sucked. They were not, it was not the kind of access that you want. It's also a little bit different for IGN because they have, we have our studio in LA. And so we did grab some folks for much better interviews. Like they came down to the studio and did like video interviews. I believe we had Todd Howard. I think someone interviewed him. I think we had Ed Boon. I think we might have interviewed Sam Lake. We definitely did some stuff with Alan Wake. But yeah, so there's like, you know, there are those opportunities. So they're all kind of, it felt to me that Keighley Show and Xbox were like these two anchors. Like they have planted some stakes in the ground. They're putting roots down at this summer event. This is not like a scoop. I mean, SGF said it's coming back next year. I do not know if Xbox is coming back next year. I would be shocked if it didn't though. And I think with those two anchors, I think other companies can conceivably look at that and go, all right, so we know that several hundred media people are all going to converge on LA this time next summer for those two events. Therefore, it is worth spending X amount of money to do something around that. It can be, maybe it's just a little mixer of our own. Maybe we have a game that we're ready to show. Maybe we just fly a couple PR people out and take some meetings. Like, I don't know what form that takes, but what I suspect is that in the next couple of years, we're going to start seeing more and more small satellite things pop up in person around that. And it's going, I can see a future where we just have this sort of decentralized, like, Summer Game Fest campus across like several square blocks of LA, where it's just a bunch of game stuff happening for several days.
I was thinking a little bit, actually I mentioned Matt Booty before, the Xbox Game Studios head. One of the like the biggest stories that I did see come out was a quote from him talking about the fact that, yeah, game dev cycles are just so long now, like 5, 6, 7 years, not uncommon. And I was thinking about that in terms of E3, even if it had managed to happen this year, that the proposition is just different at the moment because those games take so long to get made. Like, how feasible is it for this annual event to have, first of all, like, actual announcements happen? Like, I saw in relation to Keighley's presentation that, like, I think GamesIndustry.biz pointed out that they showed 42 games, but only 8 of them were things we hadn't seen before. And that's I see where that's coming from, because if these games take so long to make and there are also other showcases, other events happening at different points in the year, like, how realistic is it for quite as many big announcements to be able to get made in that one space, and more than that, then also perhaps have like playable builds of things at the same time? It seems like a bigger ask, like, today than it did when I used to like attend E3 with Eurogamer. Does that feel right to you?
Oh yeah, that's absolutely right. I think that is correct. I think I've seen kind of some people who are kind of like sort of rolling their eyes at Matt Booty saying that, like, oh well, he's just like making an excuse for Xbox's output. He's not wrong. Like, I mean, you talk to developers. I've talked to enough AAA developers across multiple studios and companies that is absolutely true. Games are taking so long to make now, and some of that is like, it's a lot of factors, right? Like, it's, you know, engines are more complicated and harder to work in, and fan expectations are much higher. Graphical expectations are much higher. Things have just ballooned out of control, and they're now like super expensive, and we've got like 800 people working on them. But then also, the pandemic messed people up. I do not think that most people realize how badly the pandemic messed up game development. And for a while, it was just, oh, it like messed up production chains, and so like games got delayed, you know, 6 months or whatever because they had to produce physical copies, or there was a chip shortage. We're still feeling the effects because there are so many games that were in like creative ideation stages in 2019, 2020, maybe 2021 that we're struggling because of work from home. And I want to be clear, like, work from home is awesome. People can absolutely be creative and can create amazing things from home, and people should be allowed to work from home. But in 2020 and 2021, we were all freaking the heck out. Like, everybody was mentally ill. Nobody knew what to do with themselves. And companies were like scrambling to get technology together and get like systems for people to be able to collaboratively and creatively work from home in these environments. And if you were doing creative ideation, you know, this thing that you typically envision as a group of like, you know, 20 people in a big boardroom with a giant whiteboard and a bunch of sticky notes, just sort of, you know, doing weird creative stuff with, like, we didn't know how to do that remotely at that time, or most people didn't. I'm sure some people knew, but most big companies didn't. And so we're now at the point where the games that should have been in creative ideation at that stage should be coming out, and they're not. And instead we're seeing all these earnings reports of people going, oh, well, we had to cancel like 10 unannounced games because we just had to do budget cuts or whatever. And, you know, we're trying to focus on the things that are working as opposed to the things that are not. And so that's kind of the situation we're in. Everything's taking longer anyway, but then we're also having these games that are taking extra long. And so the idea of having this having multiple big blowout summer showcases for Xbox and PC gaming and Ubisoft and all these other things crammed into the single week, but then also having something to show at GDC and also having something to show, not GDC, Gamescom. Also having something to show at the Game Awards, and then also maybe doing your own showcase later. No, absolutely not. You don't have time. You don't have games ready. And you don't want to end up in a situation where you're announcing Beyond Good and Evil 2 and then it's vanishing into the ether. So, yeah, that's my rant on that.
I guess one follow-up to that then is, you talked about how, yeah, maybe a vision 10 years from now is like what Summer Games Fest becomes. And maybe as you said, that could also be like not one event, but like a bunch of satellite things that are kind of tied together. So do you not see any real possibility for E3 to be, to make its like revival next year and to somehow evolve to fit this new world of ours?
Everything that I have heard and seen is that the ESA does not have either the people behind the scenes. I mean, no, this is not a slam on ReadPop, which is also my former employer.
But ReadPop was almost my former employer. I just left just before it
took over.
But yeah, ReadPop now owns GamesIndustry.biz and Eurogamer. We should say.
ReadPop PAXs are great. This is not a slam on ReadPop. But I do not think the ESA has the people do not have confidence in it, nor does it have the people at the ESA who are able to run the kind and scale of event that E3 needs to be. E3 has needed to evolve for a long time, and they have not been able to adapt to that. And it's become very clear. And I think they would be utter fools to try at this stage. I wouldn't be shocked if they took the E3 branding and tried to do something with it, like if they tried to sell it to Keighley, maybe, E4, or if or I don't know. I actually wouldn't be surprised if they tried to revive it in a couple of years as just like a business conference attached to all. Like, I don't know. I think there's different possibilities. We might see the branding rear its head once again, but I don't think we're ever going to have anything that is E3. I think it needs to move over and make room for a new thing. And I don't know if what we have now is going to be successful. I hope it is, because I genuinely like D3. I liked a lot of things about it. I'm a silly gamer. I like video games. I like seeing a bunch of them and playing them. And I like talking to people about how games get made. And it was a great way to sort of do that face to face once a year. So
what do you think your best games event is in terms of attending, to try and find interesting stories to work on, or try to find the right people that could eventually lead you in that direction? Like, where would you go as a budding games reporter if you could pick a show or an event?
I have a two-part answer for you.
Sure.
It's circumstances. So the actual best answer is GDC, because that's where the developers are, and you don't need to buy a pass for that. I mean, you can go. The talks are really good. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, if you're media, you can just get in. But if you're just like a freelancer with no bylines, you know, maybe you can't get in. But going and sitting out at Yerba Buena Gardens, which is across the street from GDC, for like a week, and just sitting out there, like, developers will just wander up to you, and you can just talk to them about mm-hmm. their games and about the
they're
stuff they're working on.
They're just roaming around, desperate for
free range to talk to.
Yeah.
And they'll just talk to you. They'll talk to you about their games. They'll talk to you about what they're feeling, what they're thinking, what they're worried about, what the industry trends are. And that is a great way to just get an idea, like get your finger on the pulse of what's going on, and get an idea of what you should be thinking about, what you should be learning, what you should be writing about. You can ask them questions. They're much more, this sounds like hostile. They're less on guard at that event, because it Absolutely. Is a game developers conference. Yep. And there's fewer PR running around to stop you from talking mm-hmm. to them. You know, be kind and empathetic. Don't like, you know, steal to have a casual conversation with someone and then go write it up somewhere. But, you know, that kind of thing. But that said, the reason why GDC isn't my only answer is because it is wildly cost prohibitive to go to that.
Oh my God.
It's in San Francisco. San Francisco is, as someone who lives there, very expensive. Most people can't buy a ticket there. And it's like staying in a hotel and all the other stuff. It's for most people, unless you already live here or have a reason to go otherwise, it's prohibitive. So my secondary answer is go to a PAX, seriously, and start talking to indie developers. PAXs are full of like really interesting games. There's usually at least a couple major companies there. I hear Nintendo's doing some big thing for PAX West. That sounds great. But yeah, there's always a lot of really interesting indie and AA games at those. And usually the booths are run by the developers at that level. Like on the triple, like Sony's booth is not run by its developers, but like all the indie booths are. And so you can just walk around, play games, and then sit there, play the thing, and then immediately turn around and talk to the person who made it. And just practice asking them questions about it. It's incredible.
I have a, I think your reasoning there is spot on. I think to give the UK version of this, which is worse,
good.
It just is worse. We have, I guess our biggest shows are like the EGX shows, which is something similar to a PAX, like more consumer focused, but with like a really good indie showing usually. And usually when you're playing a game, the person standing behind you judging the fact that you've like absolutely not interpreted their game in the correct way is the game developer, which is great. And that can be really, really good. It's, I think, the first set of press trips that I did were to those. However, Brighton has like a really, Brighton in the UK, the south coast of England, has a show called Develop, which is, even comparing it to GDC is kind of embarrassing, but it's like, it's got GDC vibes. It's like meant for people in the games industry. Although you're not, like a lot of the talks may not be for you, may not be the place to go and get stories. They're just like a bunch of people in the same place. And it has that kind of vibe that you're talking about with GDC, where you will just be able to speak to game developers without it being like this formal thing with PR presence and the rest of it. And I actually really like that show. It is not as glamorous as GDC, I should point out. It's like in an old hotel, and we don't have sandy beaches or the sun, but we do have like
pebbles. Well, we don't have that either.
Okay, well, you've got the sun. But also, one other thing I wanted to mention whilst I was thinking about it, as someone who doesn't go to GDC anymore because of the expense, typically, you can still apply for a media badge and you'll still get access to all the digital talks without needing to pay for it. So that's sometimes useful for people who can't afford San Francisco. So that's
also a great way to get to know game developers is to watch their talk. And then if you really like a talk, just kick them a message and say, hey, I really liked your talk on this. I learned X. And like, the conversation doesn't have to go beyond that, but just like, having a positive conversation with somebody about something you genuinely liked is a really great way to get to know them.
Multiple People Make Games videos have started that way, basically.
That's
so
great.
Yeah, it's a very good tip. Okay, well, Rebecca, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. You are just as enthusiastic and talented as I hoped you would be, so it's been really nice to hang out for a little bit.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Games Press. If you'd like to join the PMG community, do take a look at our Patreon over at patreon.com/peoplemakegames. We're almost entirely funded by people just like you, and well, we'd really appreciate it. So yeah, thanks, and we'll see you next time. Cheers very much.